WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. The quintessential July 4th image is the American small town. But small towns aren't what they used to be. Some are dying because of economic bust. Others are being transformed by economic boom. My guest Ron Powers has written a new book called Far From Home that creates portraits of two small towns, Cairo, Illinois, a victim of depression, and Kent, Connecticut, a victim of development. Powers grew up in a small town in Missouri, where his father was the Fuller Brushman. But Powers left his hometown for a career in journalism. He won a 1973 Pulitzer Prize for his TV criticism at the Chicago Sun-Times. In the 80s, he reached a wider audience as media critic on CBS Sunday Morning. While he was working on that show, he bought a weekend house in Kent, Connecticut, one of the towns he profiles in the book. But he since left his network job, sold the house, and moved to Middlebury, Vermont. I asked him if the deaths of small towns are going unnoticed because we're so preoccupied with decaying cities.
Well, I think it's more a case of the fact that Americans have a fantasy, a necessary fantasy, that small towns are there and they're going to be there when we need them. I think that's a fantasy that is kind of kept alive by commercials and by certain presidential candidates who campaign on grassroots Main Street platforms. And I think Americans need to know that because it is just about the last remaining link we have with this agrarian past of ours. So I think it's more of a sort of a happy wish that when things get too bad and too corrupt and too dangerous and overcrowded in the cities, we can always get in the car and find our hometown. And my message in Far From Home is that that hometown doesn't exist anymore.
Well, one example you use is a place that you lived for weekends for a few years, and that was in Kent, Connecticut. Let me ask you to describe what kind of town this was like at about the time that you moved there in, what, the mid-80s?
Yes. Kent was and still is, I think, a little sort of pre-revolutionary village with a very strong sense of its own history. Nestled in the foothills of the Berkshires, about 80 miles north of New York City. And because it's not on a superhighway and it requires a couple of dirt roads and at least one covered bridge to get to, it hasn't been overrun, or at least it hadn't been overrun at the time my family and I went out there in the early 80s. But in the mid-80s, it was Kent's turn. And as we settled into what we thought was going to be a happy life of weekending parents and meeting new neighbors and looking at the landscape and the rivers and the darkness and the fireflies, we realized that we were part of a problem, a migratory wave that was changing the town, colonizing it, and really pushing the native people, the generational people of Kent, back off their native soil.
Now, how did people like you end up pushing out the people who had lived there for generations?
Well, I wasn't a very big part of the problem, Terry, because
confess.
Because I couldn't afford it. I wasn't that rich. I couldn't buy a dairy farm. I could buy a little sort of modified cape house on the edge of town, which was quite lovely for us and very much of a solace to our little boys. But for every house that was bought, exponentially, as the houses got into the farmhouse stage, the property values went up, the property taxes went up. A new family or an old generational family had to find a new place to live that was farther from the town center. And the infrastructure of Kent, the connective tissue, the people who delivered hot meals to old people and sat on the planning commission and that volunteer ambulance people were that much more fragmented. The hardware stores gave way to Chinese takeouts, and we kind of brought the city with us. And pretty soon, the town had become a kind of a cartoon recreation or recreation of an authentic village.
When did the developers start moving into Kent, and how did they get in?
Well, they came in, I think, 1980, 1981, when the stock market sort of jumped up after Reagan's election and a lot of money-type people had a lot of extra cash at their disposal. There really was a kind of fanning out across, certainly across New England, maybe other parts of the countries, too. not only to find charming villages to spend weekends in, but to speculate in unzoned property often, and to come into a little village where deals were done on a handshake and the trust and the goodwill of the buyer to buy up a lot of land and then suddenly spaghetti strip it for a line of condominiums or of commercial businesses. And that sort of just continued. The shock waves kind of replicated themselves as the years went on. A house that might have been owned by a family for 150 years and perhaps was purchased for $20,000 could easily have been sold by the end of the 80s for a couple of million. And farmers who were cash poor and land rich had very little choice in this matter. With great reluctance, they sold to the developers, and this kind of trend continued.
So if we're looking at Kent as a typical small town that was changed by prosperity, how did the developers change the area? What kinds of buildings exist there that weren't there in the 70s? You mentioned condominiums. Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of condominiums, shopping malls, shopping strips?
There in the town of Danbury, which I guess if you go back into American history, you might remember a charming phrase called the Danbury Fair. It was kind of a great Connecticut State Fair in the great summers of our tribal history. Horse races, men in straw hats, a great festival of livestock and amusements and things like that. There is now something called the Danbury Fair Shopping Mall. It is a giant octopus with all kinds of tentacles on a great bed of asphalt, one of the largest in New England. And it has sort of, it's been very successful, but it has leached the local storefront owner practically out of existence, not only in Danbury, but in surrounding towns that reach, up to Kent and beyond. So there's that kind of development. There is the sort of mock federal shopping mall that gets put up in a little town like Kent, where the buildings look like a place where George Washington might have slept, but they in fact sell honeydew peanut butter mustard and and tanning salons, and a mock federal tanning salon is a sight to behold, I guarantee you.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Ron Powers, and his new book is about small towns. It's called Far From Home: Life and Loss into American Towns. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about small towns, and my guest is Ron Powers. In 1988, you sold your home in Kent, and you moved to Middlebury, Vermont to become a full-time resident there. It was mm-hmm. no longer a weekend type of thing going back and forth between the city and the country. Why did you want to move out of the city full-time?
The city just wasn't making sense. I mean, I had a job in communications. I was at CBS News. I was working for a program that I admired, Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt. I liked doing the program. But I suddenly realized, or gradually realized, that in order to do what I liked to do, which was be on television for 4 minutes a week, I was sitting in an office without windows, eating stale bagels from across the street and waiting for the phone to ring. And life was going by, and all of my kind of tribal memories of life in a small town were getting stale. And it just became a real drive, partly to be able to implant in my sons, whose names are Dean and Kevin, who are 9 and 6, and they're terrific kids, a sense of what nighttime is like as opposed to dangerous urban darkness, and a sense of what trees smell like when the seasons change. All those corny things were very important to me. It was a risk. It was a leap that I think a lot of city people are very reluctant to take because we're cutting an umbilical cord. Our livelihoods may not be quite so secure. Once we had implanted ourselves in Middlebury, we never looked back, and we became part of a community that really is trying to not only keep itself going, but look after itself.
When you were living as a weekender in Kent, Connecticut, you weren't able to join volunteer organizations and things like that. Now that you're living full-time in Vermont, are you a member of those volunteer organizations?
Oh, sure. I'm the chairman of the St. Stephen's Episcopal Church Peasant Market, and if you're looking for a bargain in blouses, you might come up and visit us on Saturday. My wife is on the search committee of the parish. We were active in school board activities. There's a wonderful infrastructure for children that we plunge ourselves into. You know, half of the counterculture came up to Vermont in the 1960s, and now they're all 45 years old, but they're still playing their guitars, and they're still drawing, and now they're transferring that kind of expertise to kids. So we don't have the cutting edge, perhaps, of a very hip, sophisticated urban school, but we have this sense of play and craft and that kind of enrichment that we really value. But I don't mean to paint a rosy picture of life in Vermont. The poor people of that state are among the poorest in America. The poverty is hidden by the mountains and the forests and by the obliviousness sometimes of the moneyed newcomers who come there to live in the towns. There is a class system at work that involves perhaps people of French-Canadian stock who are among the dispossessed. The dairy farms are failing. And the only reason, I suppose, Terry, that we don't have a racial crisis is that we never imported a black labor force into Vermont in the 19th century. So I don't mean to say that I'm living in Shangri-La. But I think that, you know, having said that much, I think that Vermont has become an interesting testing ground for a lot of the choices that we're all going to have to face. The scarcity of land, the scarcity of the topsoil, pollution of lakes, what we want to do with the land that we live on. And I think to that extent, Vermont is performing a necessary cutting-edge function in this country's choices.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the planned communities that have gotten started in some areas? And there's a new kind of plant community that's really trying to work on the small town model, but it's being built more or less from scratch.
I guess I have my doubts because planning often comes from a distant place. It comes from a kind of theory about what might work in a region. And I'm very much in the thrall of a wonderful American writer named Wendell Berry, Kentucky hillside farmer and poet and essayist who's been warning us for years now in his writings that we cannot continue to trust the theories of corporations, of university sociologists. We have to know the local region. We have to know the nuances of the place, how it responds to growth, how the seasons change, what the contours of the land are like. I think that planning, sort of like the use of consultants in industry and education and the media and these things, is a kind of pathology. It's a conceit that we can outsmart nature and the land itself. I do believe that we're going to have to get back to local systems of growth and manufacture and consumption if we're going to reverse this kind of mindless centralization that's been happening since the end of World War II.
You were talking to us today from an NPR bureau in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how often you go into the city nowadays, but what's it like for you when you're in Manhattan?
It's amazing how quickly you lose your scar tissue. you lose your resilience against the screamings of deranged people, the dispossessed on the streets, the aggression of traffic, the kind of, not necessarily the fear that people talk about in cities, but almost the anger. I think the thing that comes back into my consciousness when I revisit New York is a kind of provisional anger that you have to have as you walk the streets. I was nearly run down by a car wheeling around a corner into my path as I was getting to the studio today. As I was sitting here waiting for the show to begin, I could hear the screaming of a police siren getting through the soundproofing of this booth. It is very much with us. And I guess what the lesson to me is that it's possible to shed that anxiety and to have a much calmer and kinder understanding of one's fellow man when that fellow man is a person rather than a statistic or, you know, an interchangeable face.
Ron Powers is the author of the new book, Far From Home. This is Fresh Air.